Well, good morning, everyone. And again, we thank all of you for being part of the 20th anniversary of the National Ethanol Conference. We did order a little warmer weather, but I assume it's warmer here than it is back home for many of you. I want to start off today's panel with a couple introductory slides. I hope what you find in these presentations not only lays out the future potential for this industry, but also a lot of opportunity existing yet today. So the past year with E85, we had more than 200 new E85 stations open. And there's been an evolution in the E85 station, the evolution of what type of stations are opening. In the past, even in my own background, there was a lot of interest in how many stations offered E85 versus how many stations or how much volume of E85 was sold. It was all about the number. Well, the number that we're looking for today is much different. It's how many gallons are sold. So we did lose some stations, some rural stations that might have sold a couple hundred gallons a month. But the new stations are in major metropolitan areas where people are and where flex fuel vehicles are, federal fleets, and more. And of course, despite some of the numbers that were tossed around yesterday, there were more FFEs that hit the road. E15, as you've heard in earlier panels, is now legal in 29 states. Through the work of RFA and some state consultants, we're making great strides, and Christy Moore has done a yeoman's work in many situations. We do have E15 available in 16 states, and there's a couple more that should fall at any day. The good news is even better, because we've heard announcements from Sheetz. We've seen action from MAPCO and Murphy USA. Those big names, those big chains are sending messages across the table, and we have interest in cities like Chicago to mandate to larger stations to offer E15. We have terminals coming to the table interested in offering E15, which changes things tremendously for those that may have an extra tank that's currently offering mid-grade or diesel fuel. But the last thing, and I know Chris Grundler has already left the property, but it is very clear, and all of us will agree, E15's biggest hurdle is the lack of parity with RVP. Whether we lose it on E10, lose the 1-pound waiver on E10, or the 1-pound waiver is extended to E15, it is critical for E15 to ever be successful. This clicker does not like me. So I give everyone a charge. I want to know, and I want to have all of you, when you go home, your favorite retailer of choice. If you haven't asked them to offer E15, or if they don't offer E85, I want all of you to at least talk to one retailer and ask them. Just last week, we were having some conversations with a couple different chains that have multiple chains under their umbrella and have several hundred stations. And their response is always, no one is asking for it. Well, a few of them found out that that's not exactly right because the Twitterverse started some campaigns. But it's important that everyone in this industry help the growth of this industry. So on that note, what allows this market to grow? Well, it's current and advanced vehicle technology. It's current infrastructure compatibility and ability to make updates to existing infrastructure to reduce that cost. Retailers have to offer it, and obviously consumers have to embrace it. And all of that is covered in this panel today and why I'm very excited. Bob Dineen always talks about how it's a thrill to do something that you love, work for an industry that you love and support, and work for great people. I actually have the pleasure today, three panelists that I all consider friends, so this is a great honor and privilege to have all of you here, and I thank you for being here. I'm going to first start off with Christy Moriarty. She's a senior analyst at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. She has over 12 years experience evaluating, developing, and deploying bioenergy projects, extensive knowledge of refueling system equipment, and compatibility with biofuels. Christy is doing a lot of work for the RFA. She's going to talk about some of that today. And please help me welcome Christy Moriarty.
Great. Well, thanks for inviting me here today. I'm happy to share some of the work that we're doing at the lab. And Brian West and I worked on the E15 project for Department of Energy years ago, and I think your hair changed colors during that time period, and then EPA approved the waiver, and I'm like, great, our work is done. Really wishful thinking, because it does take a lot more work to get a fuel once approved out into the marketplace. So what NREL is currently working on for Renewable Fuels Association is trying to see what we can do with the compatibility of equipment with E15 and better understand the situation. So we conducted a literature review just looking for over the long deployment of E10 nationwide. Did that lead to any leaks or problems with the specific pieces of equipment? And then we're also working on a diagram of all the fuel and vapor equipment at a station. Is it UL listed? What is the materials in it? Is it compatible? And working with the manufacturers of equipment to understand what's compatible with E15 and other ethanol blends. So at gas stations, a lot of things happen there. We want you to have a safe refueling experience regardless of what fuel you're using. If you drive away with the nozzle, there's a breakaway so you don't pull the dispenser out. The picture next to that was a police chase that hit the dispenser, and the equipment worked as it's supposed to. It sheared off the valves at the bottom, cutting off the flow of fuel and vapor. I think that's Southwest's only accident. Fortunately, they did not hit the gas station. And then I guess it's not uncommon if your car is on fire for people to pull into a gas station. You should not do that. It's a super bad idea. So these statistics are from, John's here from National Association of Convenience Stores Owners Industry Group, and they put out a great publication every year with their Retail Fuels Report, so I pulled the latest statistics. Most refueling still occurs 80% at convenience stores, and then we're still seeing more growth in the hypermarkets. So that's your big box retailers like Sam's Club and Walmart that are selling fuel as well. So the vast majority of gas stations out there are a single store owner. I did see a Hart Energy, their fuels magazine, thought that maybe with the upcoming fuel economy improvements that you could see some consolidation of that to being more in the convenience store larger chains. And about 50% of the stations sell branded fuels, and what that means is, you know, if you see a Conoco station, it's not owned by Conoco. It's probably just owned by John Smith down the street. And they have a contract with that oil company or refiner to sell certain volumes of fuel. So if they wanted to sell E15, they're still going to have to meet the sales volume requirements under their contract. So just something to consider. The profits on gas sold per gallon are not very high. And even though most of the sales at a station our fuel, most of the profits come from going in the store, and I love going to 7-Eleven. I buy super overpriced firewood there and other things. So, and then I just looked at the 2013 profits and divided it by the stores, and the average profit was $55,000. So just in terms of infrastructure and where we are today, at least with E85, I always like to look at the maps because those darker concentrations are counties that have higher levels of FFVs, so there's definitely more opportunity to deploy E85 stations where the vehicles are. And then when it comes to the fuels and the infrastructure, you know, it's like, who regulates it? We get so many questions about tanks, probably every conference I'm at or meeting, a lot of questions there. We wonder, is the existing equipment compatible? What do the stations need to consider? So I know you can't read this, but the point of this slide is that underground storage tank system, there is a lot of equipment, and the vast majority of that equipment is for preventing leaks, containing leaks, detecting leaks. On the left-hand side there is just monitoring equipment. In the middle is where the fuel is delivered and has overfill prevention. And those boxes you see over are called sumps that contain any leaks. On the right side, there's leak detection equipment and also the equipment that conveys the fuel up into the dispenser area. And then you have vapor venting and then what you all are used to seeing, the dispenser itself and the hanging hardware. So in terms of the manufacturers, I don't know if it's well known or not, but pretty much all of the manufacturers of equipment at refueling stations are U.S.-based. They export all over the world. So we have steel tanks. There's a lot of different companies. And fiberglass, there's just two companies. These are some of the dispenser manufacturers and hanging hardware manufacturers and other associated tank equipment manufacturers. And you can see I have that little box of non-U.S. companies that are here. And when it comes to regulations, it's just a patchwork. There's really not one entity that oversees everything there. EPA has the Office of Underground Storage Tanks, so they're just interested in what's below the ground. OSHA, they do have a requirement that's been on the books a long time that requires that certain pieces of equipment be third-party listed for the fuel dispensed. And there is a fire code that covers refueling stations. This isn't an all-inclusive list, but these are some of the organizations that develop standards and tests and best practices. So Underwriter Laboratory, the manufacturers aren't a big fan of them, but they're the only third-party certification laboratory in this country. DOE once asked me, we'll go somewhere else in the world and find somewhere else. UL's also in Asia. There's just not somewhere else to go. And they have a number of different listings that cover equipment, and all the tests are different. Some of them are easier to pass. Some of them are difficult. And in the past, the way their standards worked is a manufacturer could go, at least with the underground equipment, and they could get listed for just petroleum products or petroleum products in E10 or petroleum products E10 in either E85 or E100, depending on the standard. But they are updating a lot of these standards, and they're requiring that the manufacturers list for all of them. And then when it comes to the above-ground equipment, for E10, the test is really easy. It's been around a long time. But for any blends above E10, they subject the equipment to 15 weeks at 60 degrees C, followed by performance testing. It's fairly difficult test to pass. And this isn't an all-inclusive list, but it's a lot of the above-ground equipment. And there is a lot of equipment that is listed. UL doesn't have a listing for E15. It's for E25 and E85. And with the changing fuels landscape, a lot of manufacturers had to upgrade elastomer materials anyway to address ultra-low sulfur diesel. So with the E25, that equipment is either the same price as conventional equipment or just slightly more expensive. When it comes to E85, there's specialized metals in there, so those prices come up quite a bit. So some of you probably have a new credit card that has a chip in it, and we're going the way of Europe and dispenser companies. It's not a federal regulation, but it looks like maybe it's October 2017, depending on the credit card company, that they're going to shift liability to the retailers. So many of them are probably going to update their electronics as a result of that. So either if they're updating their electronics, that's a good opportunity to also retrofit with the E25 kit if you want to sell E15. Or if you're replacing, then that's a good time to spend just a few $100 more to get an E25 compatible dispenser. So with tanks, it's probably the question that I get the most often, and EPA's Office of Underground Storage Tank recognizes that tanks are in the ground a very long time, so they developed a guidance in 2011 to address that. And the guidance allowed to meet federal code for tank manufacturers to issue letters stating compatibility with specific ethanol blends, and all of them have done that over time. And we do expect that to become a part of the permanent code once they update their code, but it's maybe 3 years late at this point. They told me spring, so when I ask next month, they'll say summer. And hopefully we'll get that soon enough, but I think that'll be really helpful for deployment. There are some tanks that are out of business, and you just can't store more than E10 in them. So you probably can't read this, but those are all the different tank companies that are existing today. All steel tanks are compatible with all ethanol blends. With fiberglass, you do need to know who your manufacturer is, if it's single or double wall, and what year it was manufactured. The number of tanks is declining over time. And with our literature review, we just went and looked at all the journals that cover things that are happening at gas stations, and we were trying to find out at any point as E10 was deployed, you know, over the past 15 years, were there leaks, were there anything happening? We basically couldn't find anything, so then we thought, all right, let's go look at the federal data on leaks, and, you know, as ethanol has been deployed, has there been more leaks? And nationwide, there's been less leaks. So then we took another step down and looked at states like Minnesota that's had E10 deployed across their whole state for a long time, and then looked at something like Mississippi, who maybe in 2007, maybe only 5% of E10 penetration rate, but then they went quickly up just to see if we could find any trends. We didn't. Also, in talking with industry experts, the same thing. They think it's just the long, slow introduction of E10 that the industry was prepared to handle it. We just couldn't find any issues. So not that you can read this, but those are the different states and nationwide where we were just looking for trends and leaks, and the trend is downwards. So a Westline article looked into data because as of 2009, there were supposed to be more in-depth reports of why leaks were happening, but when the data was looked at, other and unknown were both where the leak was coming from and the cause. Otherwise, tanks is up there at almost a third. And we hear a lot about STPs, that's a submersible turbine pump, but you can see that's really low. So then when you look at the causes, of course, those are unknown or other, so that's not really helpful. But in terms of the ones that are physical and mechanical damage or the overfill or the spills or the installation problems, those would have happened regardless of the fuel stored. The corrosion, that certainly could have had to do something with the fuel stored. Pipes is another thing we get a lot of questions about, and you're not going to find metal pipes out there. The installed base is a pretty even mix of fiberglass and flexible plastic, but over time there's definitely being more flexible plastic installed because it's jointless. These are all the companies that sell pipes in the U.S., and all of them have E100 listing from UL, and those are the years that they obtained it. And then there's a whole bunch of associated equipment, some of which UL lists, some of which they don't, some of which American Petroleum Institute has best practices for. So I'm just working on developing a list of all of that equipment. And certainly there's more compatibility with E15 and E85. But then even after we know all that, there is the challenge that stations may not have records. There's no regulation that requires them to have records. So in order to determine compatibility, you really have to know what equipment you have. And just an example with the tank, I was really surprised, but the plate with the manufacturer's name and the date of manufacture is not at any of the tank access points. So there are ways to figure out what tank you have, but if anything could be done to have records for all these stations, I think that would be tremendously useful going forward. And I look forward to all your questions later, and here's a list of some good resources and those compatibility letters for the EPA's Office of Underground Storage Tank Compliance.
I don't think anyone in the room thought it was easy, but that's just a glimpse of reality dealing with retailers and getting this fuel out to market. Our next speaker is John Eichberger. You've already seen John on stage during yesterday's Washington Insider panel. John has been with the National Association of Convenience Stores for several years and recently launched the Fuels Institute, which I'm happy to be a part of on the advisor side. We meet about 3 or 4 times a year now and discuss several things. Hopefully all of you have seen the recent E85 report. John's going to discuss some of that today. Talk about opportunities and all, obviously the challenges as well. Please help me welcome John Eichberger.
Good morning. You know, it's always a challenge when you speak 2 days at a conference, because if you really screw up day one, they disinvite you to day two. So I'm really kind of questioning whether I was honest enough yesterday with Bob that he allowed me to come back today. But with that, I do want to talk about, real quick, give you an overview of the Fuels Institute and then dive into the findings of our E85 study. As Robert said, the Fuels Institute is very diverse. You know, Bob yesterday kind of poked a little fun at me that NACS is the founding organization of the Institute. NACS is an advocacy organization. The Fuels Institute is not. And we've really made a great effort to diversify our advisors and our board of directors. If you look up here, there are people on this board who very rarely sit in the same room together. And the whole idea of that is to make sure that they're sharing perspectives with people from different walks of the industries. Make sure the autos are there, the engine makers, the biofuels producers, the retailers, the refiners, the industry analysts. Make sure that everybody can share perspective, because if you can raise the level of awareness of all the factors that influence the market, you can make more informed decisions going forward. And as I mentioned yesterday, I do want to point out, if you look at the second column there, RFA is part of the Institute. So we do have the ethanol industry's perspective, growth industries there. POET Ethanol Products is on our board of directors. We're making sure that your industry is well represented when we look at the different factors affecting the market. Now, we do not advocate, so what I'm going to walk through in terms of our E85 report is an analysis of what's going on in the market. So the Board of Advisors were talking about this during our first in-person meeting, actually. So, you know, there's a lot of information being thrown around about E85. There are some retailers saying, you know what, I can't sell a single gallon of it, no matter what price I price it at. There's a guy that's confident, I don't know if Mike's in the audience, but in San Diego, he's generating 20 to 25% of his overall volume is E85 in San Diego, not what you would normally consider the mecca of ethanol demand. So you've got this range. And so we start saying, what's really going on out there? What are the benchmarking metrics that retailers should be able to focus on to determine if investing in E85 makes sense? So we went out and tried to do that. This report, it's very important that we note, it is not an analysis of what does it take to bring E85 to market. It was an analysis of, if you're selling E85, what might you expect from a volume, price, margin standpoint? What are the existing E85 retailers experiencing in their performance of selling the product? So I went out to several companies I knew sold the E85, and I personally asked them, would you be willing to share with me your daily sales data on E85 and unleaded? Can you provide me gallons, margins, and price on both products so I can do some comparison analysis? And we received that specific data from 200 stores. We received other data on a monthly or less robust basis from another 64. And we took that, really cooked it. It's a year and a half worth of data. Analyzed it, put it together, and tried to find out what it said. So what we're going to walk through is what we actually found. From that finding, we then took the data and said, okay, if certain conditions permeate through 2023, how much E85 could be sold in 2023 if certain things are true? So let's take a look at what the data said. First of all, there's a lot of controversy about how many stations are out there selling E85. And I know RFA took Department of Energy and AFDC to task on their station counts. So what I did, I took a look at RFA's numbers, I took a look at the AFDC numbers and Growth Energy's numbers, and what we found is that since 2007, the number of stations have increased approximately 14% every year. That's a pretty good uptick. Now, there's a lot of people say, look, nobody's putting in E85 stations. There's some people in my industry say, it's just too expensive to put in E85 stations. If that was the case, we wouldn't have a 14% growth rate every year. Now, when we look into the forecast, we'll sustain that through 2023, see what it means. But that's the situation we're looking at now. There's also a lot of controversy on flex fuel vehicle registrations. I don't know why there's a lot of controversy. There's a lot of companies out there that analyze registration data to tell you what's going on. But this is the number since 2007. Cumulatively, we've had about 250% increase in FFV registrations. Now, when we look at the forecast, we may have some complications because the CAFE credits are going away, and the incentive for the automakers to produce flex fuel vehicles could diminish. But we're looking at a situation where there's approximately 16 to 17 million FFVs at the time we published this report last fall, and that number is approximately 7%, 6 or 7% of the entire light-duty vehicle population in the market. Now, that's important, because if you're a retailer thinking about putting in E85, what is your potential customer base? It's the number of FFV customers in your market. If the national average concentration is about 6 or 7%, you assume about 6 or 7% of your customers might be able to buy E85 if you offer it and you offer it at the right competitive price. It's important to know that there's a lot of room for growth. So if you take a look at the total number of vehicles in the country and you compare it to the total number of gasoline retail stations, then you look at the total number of flex fuel vehicles compared to the total number of E85 stations, your station density is there are 5,300 vehicles per station in the United States. there are only 1,466 FFVs per E85 station in the United States. Now, when you have everybody buying gasoline, you need to have a lot more competition. You probably don't need to get to a 5,000 vehicle-to-station density to make E85 make sense, but there is a lot of room to accommodate additional stations and additional vehicles, so there's room for growth within the E85 market. We looked at three different data sets. One was at the bottom there, Minnesota publishes monthly data. Now, there's a lot of people who say the Minnesota data is very suspect, but you know what? It's a data set. It's worth looking at to see what it says. We also took a look at NACS owns a company called CSX. CSX collects scan-level data of everything sold every month from about 7,000 stores. We analyzed that. Now, in that data set, going back to, I think went back to 2008 on that data set, there's only about 100 to 120 stores that report E85 sales. Put that in there, and then the Fuels Institute data. What this shows is the average monthly E85 sales for those categories ranges from about 2,800 gallons of E85 to about 5,500 gallons of E85. The discount ranges from 35 cents below unleaded to 51 cents below unleaded. Now, keep in mind, look at that. That's a percentage that never exceeds 16% discount. A lot of people will say that in order to sell E85, you have to compensate for the energy deficit, which is between 20 and 25% on an average basis. What we're finding is that's not true. The customer isn't calculating what percentage discount do I need. They're calculating, okay, is that 50 cents discount enough for me? Is that an incentive for me to buy the product? And that's driving sales. But I want to point out, when we're talking about the monthly gallons, is 5,000 gallons a lot? Well, it depends on how many gallons of fuel you sell. So we compared it to how many gallons of E85, how many gallons of unleaded are sold, what's the percentage? So in the Fuels Institute data, we averaged 2.8%. E85 averaged 2.8% of the total unleaded sales. Now, each retailer can ask, is 3% volume enough for me to justify the investment in E85? And that's for them to determine. So let's take a look specifically at the station-level data that was delivered to me directly on a daily basis. No, thanks, man. Appreciate it. So E85, this shows every single station that gave us data, and like I said before, it's about 2.8% of unleaded sales. Now, we do see in the market there one store that actually recorded about 11% volume of their unleaded sales volume. Now, that's an anomaly. Most are not that high, so 3% is the average. But what I really wanted to focus on today was take those 200 stores that gave me data, and I identified the 10 stores that had the highest E85 volumes. I wanted to know, what are the best of the best doing? Now, keep in mind, this data set, I know these companies very well. I have not divulged who any of the companies are. I can tell you this. They're chain retailers. They're unbranded, so they're not dealing with brand restrictions. They are considered among the best operators in the convenience store industry. So you're looking at the top 10 E85 sellers from some of the best retailers in the country. And what we're seeing here is that on average, they price E85 50 cents below unleaded, and they average 6% of their unleaded sales volume as an uplift. Now, is that a lot? Well, if your FFV population is only 6%, guess what? Maybe you are capturing the entire potential market of the FFV E85 demand in your market. Maybe. It's a huge jump. It's just combining two different stats, but one can make that argument. Retailer can determine is 6% sales uplift worth dedicating a dispenser, a tank, and doing the uplift in terms of getting E85 to market. Now, look at 60 cents below. That's a 7.5% sales share. Now, one of the things that concerns me is even when RINs prices spiked and we were able to sell E85 to these stores at $1.20 below gasoline, we only got to 9.5% volume. That could be because constraints on the number of FFVs. I would suspect if you're $1.20 below unleaded, every FFE driver in the world would be coming to your store to buy E85. We didn't see that, so there are some limitations in terms of what can be done. Of those top 10 stores, this is the frequency of discounts. The most popular discount is in the 40 to 50 cent range, and that seems to be consistent. That station in San Diego I told you about, he told me the magic is 50 cents. If you're 50 cents below unleaded, you're going to get loyal customers. Now, think about that. It may not be, you know, Christy pointed out a lot of NACS data, and I really appreciate that. I love when people use our data, and I don't have to. It's a wonderful affirmation of our work. But the retailers aren't making money at the fuel island. They're making a couple pennies a gallon. On E85, they sometimes make quite a bit more, sometimes not. But they're trying to get customers in the store. So if you can develop a stickiness with your customer, And we use the term stickiness. That E85 customer knows that you're selling E85, you're consistently 50 cents below gasoline, and they come to you all the time, which is what's happening in that San Diego store. Then you develop a customer loyalty, which hopefully gets them inside the store to buy a cup of coffee where you make all your money. You sell one cup of coffee, the rest of the pot is profit. Can't say the same about an underground store tank full of fuel. But if you get those customers to be loyal, and E85 is a tool to do that, that's where you want to go. All right, so let's take a look. What does that mean in terms of 2023? Now, one of the things that's going on in Washington is the White House is inferring that E85 is a solution to the RFS. There are a lot of people who say we don't think that's the case. They're really questioning whether or not E85 can bridge the gap between E10, the modest E15 that Robert talked about, and the requirements for 2023. So we want to look at, see, in these scenarios, what is the potential for E85 sales? So we have to take a look at what the station count is. So if the E85 station count increases at historic rates, and I took an average of the growth energy RFA and AFDC numbers, extrapolated those to 2023, we're looking at around 10,000 stores by 2023. So that's going to be about 8% of the convenience store population, about 6% of the total retail fueling population in the country. If flex fuel vehicles continue to increase at historic rates, we may have around 26 million FFVs by 2023, which would be closer to 10% market share. Now, the auto industry has to make a couple decisions. Their CAFE credits pretty much expire in 2019. So are they going to continue making flex fuel vehicles? And my argument is they will if the customers are asking for it. If the demand for E85 picks up, the customers will be asking for flex fuel vehicles because they want to buy the product, and that'll give a market signal to the automakers to keep producing it. Absent that market signal, the number of FFEs could diminish, which really puts an anchor on the growth potential for E85. Now, here's where it gets interesting. I want to point out the big number first, which is this guy right here. If every flex fuel vehicle forecast in 2023 fueled with E85 100% of the time, we're going to sell around 32 billion gallons of E85. That's your market cap potential, 32 billion gallons. Customers today are fueling up with E85 less than 1% of the time. So let's say they only fuel with E85 5% of the time. You're going to be about 1.6 billion gallons of E85 in 2023. There is a huge amount of growth potential here. To convert FFE drivers to buy E85, you need to have stations in their location. You need to have E85 priced at the right level in order to encourage them to buy the product. But there is market potential here, and that's your range based upon a driver consumption model. Now let's take a look at the stores themselves. If the stores, every store in the country performs at certain levels consistent with our model, so if every single store performed at the level of the top 10, which is this number right here, the top 10 stores that we profiled, we're going to sell about 4.5 billion gallons of E85 in 2025. That is just a little bit higher than EIA's forecast, but it's based upon top-level performance within the convenience store industry selling E85. If the market only matches the average of the sample set that we analyzed, we're only going to sell 1.1 billion gallons of E85. Average performance recorded in the last year and a half is not sufficient to drive the E85 market to increase volume. Additional efforts need to be put in place to drive the market to get these retailers to perform at a higher level, and that's going to require customer education, increased flex fuel vehicles, better pricing and better commodity prices, better marketing assistance. All those things need to combine with the E85 retailers to get them to aspire and move into that higher echelon of performance. If we continue to perform at the average level, E85 is not going to be a very big contributor to the RFS in the long term. So how does it break down? Again, I mentioned that you don't know, is 3.5 billion gallons a lot? Is 1.5 billion gallons a lot? What is it as a percentage of the gasoline forecast demand in 2023? EIA's forecast of 3.4 billion gallons is just under 3% gasoline demand. Is that a representative number? Is that something that should be acceptable? Is that an appropriate number for the retailers to think I can do that at 3%? It's a little bit higher than, that's 2.87. It's right at where my top 10 retailers were averaging in terms of their percentage. If the top 10 stores, if we match their performance, we're at 3.7%. So you're getting a little bit better. Now, for RFS purposes, we need to think about how does it affect the overall ethanol? Because E85 itself is not a RFS number the ethanol content is, and depends on the ethanol blend rate. And I tell you, I asked the guys who gave me the numbers, they're averaging about 74% blend on average. Some of them are 83, some of them are 85, which they shouldn't be doing. Some are 51, based on blending economics, but 74% is what EIA uses in their forecast, and that's pretty consistent with what I heard from the sample set we received. This tells you what the ethanol contribution in the RFS would be through E85 at those different forecasts. So that's pretty much the summary, and I'm looking forward to the conversation afterwards, but the bottom line is there's a lot of potential for E85, but there's going to need to be a lot of work to improve the marketing and the price competitiveness, to educate consumers, to drive demand signals so the automakers continue producing FFVs. Because if FFVs aren't there, the retailers will not offer E85. So I think there's opportunities, and I hope to have a discussion in a few minutes. Thank you very much.
It's always great to hear there's opportunity. Our last speaker, but definitely not, shouldn't be discounted in any fashion, Brian West, is the Deputy Director of Fuels, Engines, and Emissions Research Center at Oak Ridge National Lab. I had the privilege of visiting Brian's office a couple weeks ago and toured the facility, and the work that's being done within our fuel is quite amazing, and I'm excited to have Brian here to share some of that with you. Please help me welcome Brian West.
Thanks. Great to be back at the Ethanol Conference again this year. Thanks for having me. I'm going to talk a little bit about the octane proposition that Bob Dineen and others have mentioned, give you a quick overview of a little bit of the work that's going on right now within DOE and with our industry partners. So as you know, octane is a really good octane booster. Ethanol is a really good octane booster. You get most of your benefit from the first little bit of ethanol, and that's really helpful. Chris Grundler was here yesterday. I don't think he mentioned renewable super premium, but if you look at the Tier 3 rule that he did mention, there's actually language in there that says they welcome the manufacturers to request approval for a new high-octane 30% ethanol blend or something like that. I don't want John to grow hair right here on stage for me saying 30%. I know John and Christy and others get more excited about E25, and that would be fine, too. Great lead-in presentations talking about the infrastructure. It's certainly not trivial to get a new mid-level blend out there, but I would argue that it's a lot easier than a hydrogen infrastructure or some of the other fuel cell vehicles and some of that kind of thing. So one thing I would define as a crying shame is I heard last year at this meeting from Wayne or Gilbarco, we replace about 20,000 dispensers a year. Is that right? So 5 years from now, if there's 100,000 new E10 dispensers out there, I would call that a crying shame. So as they're getting replaced, we definitely need to be trying to get E25 or E85 dispensers into place. So let's just talk a little bit about why octane is really good for your engine, why it's good for efficiency. You can make more torque and power, and if you can make more torque and power, then you can put a smaller engine in the car and get better fuel economy. I've got an engine map shown there. The red polygon is outlining the engine map that you get with your standard 9.2 compression ratio and 87 octane gasoline. This is a real production engine. It's a GM LNF. It's a single cylinder version, but this is from about 2007, like the Pontiac Solstice. So that's a perfectly fine engine map, and they've sold lots of those engines. If you raise the compression ratio to 12:1, we significantly reduce the available torque because of NOC, you just have to limit the breathing. Get a little bit better efficiency, but you have a really severe power loss. If we swap the fuel out for 100 RON E30, we double the torque available from that 9:1 compression ratio. And this red line here, this is a line of constant power. So you can imagine in today's engine, if you're cruising along at, say, 2,800 RPM, making some level of horsepower, and what downspeeding and downsizing means is I can slide up that red curve over to the left and make the same amount of power at, say, 1,600 RPM. And if you can do that, you're in a more efficient region of the map, and that's why we can save gas doing that. So we're calling this renewable super premium. Bob called it that. I'll mention later that maybe we need to come up with a new name. But what's exciting about this is the volumetric fuel economy parity that Bob Dineen mentioned it. If E25 or E30 can get the same fuel economy despite the lower energy density as E10 in a conventional vehicle, then every gallon of gasoline is every gallon of ethanol, excuse me, is displacing a full gallon of gas, not two-thirds of a gallon the way it does today. So is 100 RON renewable super premium the fuel of the future? I hope so. Maybe we need to call it new regular. Some people don't like the term premium. I'm not a marketing guy. I'm an engineer. So let me just talk real quickly about a little bit of the work that's going on at DOE. I'm going to go through these very quickly. Industry and DOE both are investing in some programs. We've got Vehicle Technologies Office at DOE. That's Pat Davis and Kevin Stork, for those of you who know those offices. Bioenergy Technologies Office, that's Jonathan Mayle and Alicia Lindauer. And we're working really closely with Ford, GM, and the Coordinating Research Council on some of these programs. So we've got a Ford 1.6-liter EcoBoost running in our cell, and one of our cells at Oak Ridge, and it's being used for both the DOE project and a funds-in project with CRC. Essentially, we'll be looking at different fuels with and without ethanol, different octane levels, and different compression ratios. We have a new project that's just getting started where GM's preparing a new LTG engine for us. That's their new 2-liter turbo GDI engine. And this is a competitively awarded DOE project, and we've partnered with CRC, and again, GM is a technical partner there as well. And then Christy mentioned that we work together on the E15 program. That's true. We've also been working together on the Bioenergy Technologies Office Renewable Super Premium pilot study. And there's several different tasks there. Christy and others have been looking at the infrastructure compatibility. Some NREL and Oak Ridge folks are looking at market analysis. This is to look at different scenarios of how you could get these new RSP cars into the marketplace, how much fuel you would sell. Argonne, of course, is famous for their GREET analysis, and they're doing well-to-wheels to look at what are the real GHG benefits of these higher efficiency RSP cars with different scenarios of where you would get that octane. I think ethanol will be a winner there. And then I've got a couple of vehicle projects I'll highlight quickly. Here's a Cadillac ATS. This is equipped with the 2-liter GM engine that I'd mentioned just a second ago. And Coleman Jones, some of you know, he's supporting us here on this project. It's very similar to the EcoBoost project I mentioned. The big difference, those engine projects, we'll run engine maps in the dyno lab and then do some vehicle modeling to predict fuel economy. And there's nothing wrong with models. That's a good way to do it, but I think a vehicle-level demo is going to make believers out of people as well. So similar type deal, we're going to look at different fuel, different ethanol levels, different octane levels, and different compression ratios. Another thing, to the FFV thing, we convinced some folks that it was worth looking for a performance benefit with today's FFVs with this renewable super premium, which is as yet undefined, but I used E30 because there's a lot of E30 data out there. I think E25 would be just as good. We acquired several legacy FFVs, and we tested them with E10 and with this E30. The E30 has 100 RON and 30% ethanol. And the best data point I'm showing you here, this is the GMC Sierra. It's a normally aspirated GDI FFV, and we found it to be almost a half second faster at 80 miles an hour. And I think if you're driving an FFV and you put E30 in it and you put your foot on the gas, you're going to feel that difference. Car and Driver tested a very similar car, the Silverado GDI pickup FFV with E85. And so what you see is that they were about 0.4 of a second faster to 60. What that's telling you again is that octane boost you get with a little bit of ethanol is you get most of it on the front end. We call this the rule of halves. You know, we're talking about 14 billion gallons of ethanol, and how do we get more ethanol in the market? If you had more people selling this E25 or E30, if half the FFVs on the road today used RSP half the time, we consume another half billion gallons of ethanol. And in one other little experiment we bootlegged that I really wanted to share with you, we had a Ford Fiesta EcoBoost in our lab recently for a different reason. But because the owner's manual, if you read that there, it says regular unleaded is recommended, but premium will provide improved performance and is recommended for severe duty usage. So we got this idea that it'd be a neat experiment to put some E15 in the car and see how it responded to that. So we blended an 87-octane E0, you see the table there, with 15% ethanol. That raised the octane number. It's very important to point out this was a premium E15, not a E15 that had been blended with a sub-octane bob. And then there's the three tests we ran, the city, the highway, and the USO6. And I want you to focus on the the circle data point there, the 0.99, the ratio of fuel economy with E15 compared to E0 was within 1% of this volumetric fuel economy parity that we're looking for with RSP. So I think that's really encouraging. We didn't modify the engine. We didn't change the compression ratio. We didn't change the shift schedule. The engine is NOx limited with 87 octane gas, and with this premium E15, the engine could run at more efficient points on the engine map and improved its fuel economy. So basically, that's a 4.5% improvement in thermal efficiency. So EPA has passed a couple of rules in the past. I just thought I'd list a couple of them here. I think they hold the key, and if regulating octane would not be a new precedent. We're the only developed nation in the world that doesn't have an octane specification as part of our fuel spec. And as you all know, in Europe, regular is 95 RON. That's very similar to our premium. So I think our manufacturers would really like to build one vehicle and sell it all over the world, not have to build different engines for different markets. So I think that's, that's the regulatory path. I know a lot of people are opposed to regulation, but if we're going to have a new fuel in the marketplace that has all these societal benefits like lower GHGs and lowered oil imports and so on, there needs to be some leadership. I threw this in just for fun. I know this is red meat for this crowd, but this is the new Koenigsegg 1-to-1. It's the world's fastest car, and it's a flex fuel vehicle. It makes over 1,300 horsepower with E85. It makes less than 1,200 horsepower with gasoline. 1,200 is still a lot, I know. But it does 0-60 in 2.5 seconds. What was Bob's quote yesterday from Bill Webkenberg? He said, you can make crazy, stupid horsepower with E85. There you go, crazy, stupid horsepower. So in closing, this is the Road to Higher Blend session. I thought I'd just give some of my opinions. These are my opinions. They're not DOE's or Oak Ridge's. These are just my opinions, and a lot of this is going to be rehashed from what you heard yesterday. How do we get more ethanol in the marketplace? Here's some of my ideas. Obviously, the RFS is important. Don't screw up the RIN market like we did a couple of years ago. I really think it's important to maintain some incentive for the OEMs to build FFVs, and I find it heartbreaking that's likely to go away, but the remarks from Christy and John are really hit home with regard to that. I see FFVs as a potential bridge to renewable super premium future, and if we've got 3,000 stations selling E85 now and those are blender pumps, then, can some pioneering marketer go ahead and start offering, don't just say E30 at your blender pump, call it renewable super premium for your FFV. Cite my report that says you get better performance and see if you can't sell more E25 that way. Continue with your efforts on E15, of course. Another thing, talked to Robert when he was down at Oak Ridge recently. He said one of the E15 blenders is going to be making a new lower octane bob to make 87 octane E15. I think that's a real lost opportunity. I'd really like to see E15 in the marketplace as a high octane fuel. I'd put it in my car. We heard this yesterday. Remember, corn ethanol is a GHG win. Even the way we use it today, where that gallon of ethanol only displaces 2/3 of a gallon of gas, with RSP, it displaces a full gallon, and that's a win. Cellulosic's even better, and then both are better still, of course. Don't overlook other biofuels like butanol. I think it could be a player, and I think long range with regard to renewable super premium. It's possible that we could have a new spec. I'm a dreamer, maybe, but we could have a new specification for this fuel that doesn't say it's 27% ethanol or it's 22% ethanol or it's 30%. Maybe it's a range, 10 to 30% ethanol, and there's a performance spec. There's the RON number. We can't get away from that. I think we'll keep that. But there's other things about ethanol that will improve engine performance that could be captured in a new fuel performance specification, in my opinion. So I'll close just by acknowledging DOE, Alicia and Kevin at DOE, my colleagues at Oak Ridge NREL and Argonne and our industrial partners. So look forward to a discussion. Thank you.
Well, what Brian didn't say was that the fastest FFV, they're going to make a whopping 7 of them. One of them will be shipped to the United States, and the price tag before the bidding starts is... $3 million. So for those of you that missed the pack auction last night and have some change left, there's an opportunity ahead. We're going to open it up for questions, so if you have a question for any of the panelists, please make your way to a microphone. I'll get us started. Christy, we've heard more recently with the Chicago E15 mandate proposal some comments from maybe some detractors that very little equipment is compatible. In fact, we've seen quotes that 80 to 90% of the tanks would not be compatible with E15. Looking at your presentation today, it seems that's really not accurate.
No, I wouldn't say we're overly concerned about tank compatibility. Since most tanks are compatible, you do need to know what tank you have, but you also have to make a decision because presumably you're already storing something in that tank. So do you want to sell E15 or do you want to install a new tank? So you do have to make a decision, but certainly tanks is not where we have a lot of concerns.
Question from the floor.
Yes, thank you. Mainly for you, Robert, but I would welcome the thoughts of all of the panelists as well. I was a little surprised in your remarks. You consistently refer to it as E85. My surprise stems from it's no longer a new revision to the ASTM specification, which now refers to it as ethanol flex fuel. And John pointed out towards the tail end of his presentation that it's a fairly wide range in terms of its neat ethanol content. It could be as low as 51%. It could be as high as 83%. And I'm even more surprised, as I suspect you're well aware, the Federal Trade Commission has a proposal that's been out for some time now, expected to be finalized in the foreseeable future, that would require the pump labels to be changed. We will no longer see the familiar E85 pump label that we see. They propose that the number would be rounded to the nearest 10, depending upon the ethanol content. So the question is, are there any moves afoot to cease referring to it as E85 and pick up on the ASTM spec language and referring to it as ethanol flex fuel? Are you hearing anything about the FTC's proposal, anything that speaks to that issue?
Well, most of the time when I refer to E85, it's intentional, and you're absolutely right. Everything you said is accurate. The federal fleets are still required to use E85, and in the ASTM specification, E85 was carved out in Class 4 so that those fleets could still meet the requirements to utilize that alternative fuel. As John mentioned, in the field, though, we're seeing an average of about 74% EIA's number, Fuels Institute number. I agree, concur. We have some terminals that no longer offer anything but E70 year-round as E85. It's a federal Department of Energy definition. I know there's some work, at least in the behind the walls, to adjust that term. And what we're going to see in the field is really a change in the orange and black label that lists a minimum ethanol content. The marketing, however, above and beyond that, from the starburst we've seen from the state of Minnesota that swept across the nation, everyone has their own little label and marketing side. We've been working with the automakers to see what the best term is, and we're starting to see E85 slowly evolve to E85 and flex fuel in owner's manuals. Really what we want to do is match the flex fuel vehicle to the flex fuel option at the dispenser, no matter its ethanol content. So good question. When we talk about it, all gallons are good, and it's ultimately up to the retailer how they're going to market it.
Quick comment regarding the FTC labeling requirements. To require the retailer to specify within the nearest 10 percentage for the flex fuel is going to be extremely complicated. It's going to make it much more complicated for retailers to bring flex fuel to market. I think the idea of marketing as flex fuel is a great idea. I've always questioned, why do we say E85? Why don't we say flex fuel? Why didn't we go for E50 or E60 or something that was a little less apparent in terms of mileage penalty for using it in a vehicle. I think the trend towards a flex fuel definition is a much more appropriate marketing tool for retailers. And as long as the labeling requirements are flexible enough to provide retailers the certainty that they put a label on it today, and if the blending economics change and they go from an E70 to an E50 or an E80 within a month or so, that they don't have to change that label, that's going to make it a lot easier for retailers to bring it to market.
Good point. Sir?
Thank you, Robert. My question is for Brian. The next generation Volt has a compression ratio of 12.5 to 1, yet it runs on 87 octane. You mentioned to Ford that you'd modified or not modified and actually changed, I presume, the mapping and increased the ethanol content, the octane, and increased the performance. It appears to me that the manufacturers, while they may not be as much on board or apparently on board with a higher octane, higher blend of ethanol, it appears they're making engines that are ready for the change, and then a simple mapping or recurving or reprogramming of the existing ECM and onboard controls would allow and facilitate a higher octane fuel. The 12.5 to 1, 1.5-liter next-gen Volt, it has an increase in MPG from 39 for its predecessor to 41 MPG. And, of course, it's just the generator. It's just a static engine. But how does that relate to the 10-to-1 compression ratio that the EcoBoost Ford uses? And are OEMs indeed creating engines all along that will burn higher octane? They're just detuned, so to speak. What's your opinion, Dr. West?
That's a good question, Bobby. I'm not intimately familiar with the new Volt engine, but I do know that there's a lot of tricks in the bag for the manufacturers, and if they're going to run 12.5 to 1 with 87 octane, they're probably going to be using copious amounts of EGR, or they're going to be using a sophisticated valve strategy to limit the breathing. So if you remember my second or third slide where I showed what happened when you went from 9-to-1 to 12-to-1 with 87 octane in that GMLNF engine, you cut the torque in half. And if the engine is just a generator, you can tolerate that. So I hope that's an answer.
No, that's fine. Thank you. I'm curious to see what the manufacturers are doing, because obviously they know how to downsize, downspeed, and increase performance and torque and run a cooler engine, and that's just an enabler for higher blends of ethanol, and that's what our game is, and that's what's good for society and for an economy that's a successful economy. I'm sure for everyone in this room that's in the business. Thank you, Brian.
Thanks. Down front.
Hi, I'm Doug Tiffany, University of Minnesota. My question sort of follows on this one, and it's directed to you, Mr. West, and that would be that some engines, say the Mazda line, that talk about SkyActiv technology, they're using a smaller displacement engine, but they're using a higher compression ratio. That engine is supposed to be better for tailpipe emissions at that higher compression. Now, would that same graphic that you showed with a higher octane give that engine much better performance too?
I mean, maybe not right out of the box, but it would certainly give the engine calibrator more knobs to turn. So to Bobby's point about the 12.5 to 1, I think the 12 active is the sky active, excuse me, is another good example where the static compression ratio or the geometric compression ratio is high, but the effective compression ratio is controlled by variable valve timing and EGR and these other things, so that they can run on 87 octane without being, I mean, they are knock limited. I won't say they're not knock limited. They're definitely knock limited with higher octane and then some twiddling of the knobs. They could certainly make more power and do it more efficiently, I think. Okay. The other thing I understand, and I'm not a controls guy, I'm not really an engine guy, but if you look at it, trends in compression ratio and specific power and octane number over the history of the country, we've had kind of static octane for the last several years, but compression ratios have crept up, and that's to the credit of the engine guys who've figured out ways around knock with engine control. Things like direct injection helps you. And again, the variable valve timing and how they breathe and those kind of things are not the engines of the 60s that just have a fixed cam and a carburetor, right? So, but I think the we're going to run up against a glass ceiling on how much further we can go if we don't change the fuel. That's my opinion.
Well, I'd agree. Yeah, there's always been coevolution between engines and the fuels that they run on. And to meet those standards of a lower tailpipe, this is a fuel that helps out, in my opinion. So, thanks.
Go ahead.
I don't know if there's a simple answer to this, but y'all may have seen something. So if any of you know anything about this issue. But in consumer behavior, if you look at a vehicle like the Toyota Prius, which was cutting edge for hybrid technology when it came out, they deliberately made the vehicle look different so the owners could identify with it. And then you look at Apple products. Apple, tremendously successful company. And design, styling, the idea of being able to identify as a consumer with a cutting-edge, high-technology product. And I don't know if we look at E85 and the higher blends as being a high-tech, but when we look at the example of the car that Mr. West brought out, do you all in consumer behavior find any, like, leadership, cutting-edge identification with the E85 customer versus an E15 customer? Strikes me as being a more like generic product, generic customer. And I'm wondering if you see any influence of the E85 enthusiasts. Is there any enthusiast component to the E85 market?
John, you want to take a stab at that?
I can take a stab at it. I think it's interesting because you're right. The Prius came out and the Honda Insight came out. They were very uniquely designed to tap into a certain mindset. You look at the population of hybrid vehicles now, though, they're ubiquitous. They're the exact same thing. You can't really tell one from the other. The Ford Escape looks like the Ford Escape. The Honda Civic looks like the Honda Civic. The Toyota Camry looks like the Toyota Camry. I don't know if there is, you mentioned E85 enthusiasts. Yeah, there's some out there. I don't know how many there are. And I don't know if you could recalibrate the design elements of a flex fuel vehicle or a high octane optimized on E15 or renewable super premium vehicle to tap into that. There's so much goes into the comprehensive marketing and design. I don't know that redesigning the vehicle will work to drive that kind of demand. I think on RSP, what I've heard from a couple of the automakers is their interest in doing this high octane fuel is to drive their high performance engines to a next level and give the customer that additional performance package associated with a higher octane fuel. That in itself could be a powerful marketing tool. Get those real gearheads out there like me who love power, who love performance. If you give me an extra 100 horsepower because I'm doing 100 RON, I may go for it immediately.
I'm thinking the new pump may be an opportunity.
A new pump? Yeah. I mean, if the pump designs are great, and I think Wayne's still here. So I think that's always an opportunity. And the retailers, if retailers investing in a new fueling system and putting in a new product, they want to sell the product. You know, it's funny because there was a report came out, and Robert and I talked about this, about possible price gouging at E85 in Missouri last year. And I questioned, I said, look, if a retailer is putting in the investment to put E85 in their station, they want to sell the product. They don't want a dispenser sitting there empty. So any type of tool that can help us sell a product we're bringing to market, I think the retailers making the investments would jump on it. And so I think there should be some research done into what would tap into that motivation of the consumer to make them buy the higher performance fuel. I think that's a great idea.
Monty?
Yes, for John, or anyone else who wants to jump in. You had some great data there on the E85 sales and maybe the disconnect between those strict BTU comparisons and price, which we've seen. But I didn't hear you mention much about blender pumps. When the big retailers are moving into Iowa, like Murphy's, they're bringing in blender pumps at every island, and they're offering an E10, a registered E15, an E30, and an E85. So you give a couple of different price options for the flex fuel vehicle, and then you can go for the regular cars as well. Have you guys looked into that as maybe a more flexible model than you either have to have, you know, E85, and if it doesn't work, you're kind of stuck?
So the Fuels Institute study did not look into that. We looked specifically at retailers who are defining themselves as E85 retailers and the product they're defining as E85. I think your point is absolutely right, and we've talked about this with E15. If you're going to be putting an E85 in the ground, then the retailer would be wise to think about, okay, is my dispenser capable of offering multiple grades, multiple blend ratios? And that provides you greater marketing opportunity. I think the critical element, I hear blender pumps all the time, blender pumps have been around a long, long time. And, you know, putting my NACS hat on, if it's not compatible, it doesn't work. So it has to be listed, it has to be legal. But once you have all the right equipment, the retailer needs to be thinking about how can I be most flexible to maximize the return on my investment. And it could be you put E15, E20, E25, E30, E85 on the same island, in the same dispenser. And then you may be able to tap in a much stronger customer base and a much better return on your investment. If that's this, if that's possible, then I encourage retailers to definitely look at it. We've not done the independent analysis of it.
Okay, thank you.
Tim, go ahead.
Thanks. Probably this question goes to Christy. In Minnesota, we're trying to work with retailers who are prepared to use their mid-grade tanks to dispense E15. And we're looking at ways in which to help the retailer cross the line without getting too tied up in the idea of concrete breaking. And we know it can be done in Minnesota. And I guess what I'm just wondering is, from your research, is there some sort of molecular divide that separates E10 from E11 up to E15, that something magically happens going from E10 to E15 and all of a sudden our systems are destroyed? And is there some sort of risk analysis that the EPA might consider to go from E10 to E15 versus E10 to E85 when we talk about component compatibility? Thank you.
Yeah, sure. The one thing with mid-grade tanks, and even in some of NREL and DOE's publications, we think we've highly overestimated that, because anytime I ask a retailer chain if they have any mid-grade tanks, they don't. Because even with the EPA's Office of Underground Storage Tanks federal code, if you have a tank sitting there for a long time and you're not throwing a fuel in it, there's several things you have to be doing, and that's fairly unattractive to retailers. I think a lot of it is just E10 was around for a long time. You know, it was grandfathered in. The reason it has the reed vapor pressure 1-pound waiver is because EPA didn't respond in 180 days, so it was automatically approved. And in this time of moving to a higher blend, even the E15, all those different organizations looked at it as a time to improve regulations. So that's just kind of what's happening. I don't think there's that much of a difference of an E10 or an E15 on the equipment. It's just the landscape for the regulations has changed.
Let me give a retailer perspective, because we've had this debate a lot. Retailers and the National Association of Convenience Stores, the petroleum industry is very concerned about compatibility to make sure that the equipment we have is safe. I have always said I am pretty highly confident that a lot of the equipment out there is safe to sell E15 and doesn't need to be replaced, but it's not recognized as safe. Consequently, it is not permissible to put it in that dispenser. And that's why we worked with RFA for several years to try to move legislation to change that definition of compatibility, to provide an alternative method of certifying an equipment to handle these new products. Congress wasn't interested because they're not interested in doing stuff that may be controversial. Let's put it that way. And I didn't think that was controversial. If it's technically safe, let us use it. But you have to give the retailer that legal protection. So there are some issues with seals and gaskets, but those can be taken care of. You know, I know both of the major dispenser manufacturers have retrofit kits to get up to E25. Why? Because there are certain components that need to be replaced. It's not a complete wholesale replacement. But UL has certified that upgrade kit, so that's a great opportunity. But we have to match technical compatibility with legal requirements in order to open the door for these products, and I think we need to stay committed to trying to do that.
Seeing no further questions and almost perfectly on time, I'll make the conference planner happy. First, I'd like to thank Christy, Brian, and John for their participation today.